The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and we appreciate your being here. I think we're going to have a real active, animated show and discussion tonight. So let me jump in and introduce the program and introduce our guest to you. So do remember that our toll-free line, for those of you who would actually like to use it, 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners, so be patient and I'll answer it and bring you up on air just as quickly as possible. You can also send emails, be succinct and short, and that email address is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, which is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So do check it out. So we have a website newsletter. You'll see it on the sort of the right side of the homepage. And that has all of the details of what's happening during the given week, like this week. And then if you scroll down further on the website newsletter, you'll see the coming attractions. So that's what we have planned. And right now we're starting to book into August of this year. And if you see an open date, that means we probably haven't filled that show yet. Then if you go over to the right sidebar, you've got recent programs. And then if you scroll down a little further, you have the upcoming shows. So remember, that is now our blog. And the upcoming shows, when you see a show listed there, then you can start posting comments for that show. I will get copies of them, and if they come in before or during the live show, I can read them on air. Otherwise, there'll be comments for the archive program, just like the old-fashioned blog that we had. And if you do go to the show for tonight, Tuesday, Wes Farah, you will note that I have already posted a comment with his website and some links to some of the material that our guest is going to be talking about tonight. So hopefully you've seen that. And if you haven't seen it, you can access it while we're talking to him on the show tonight. Do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and we encourage you to share our programming with other people. You can actually send a show to someone over the Internet if you want to do it. It's about 25 megabytes. Or you can just tell people the URL and let them download the shows themselves. There are a couple of simple rules attached to this. So one of them is, as I say all the time, don't do anything commercial with the program. Number two, no edits, cuts, clips, no uploads of anything to YouTube or to any other website, including your own. And then, in addition, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we really appreciate your honoring that. Our copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com website pages, as well as the website pages for the guest. For the parent. I'm getting a barrage of emails already. Wow. so that you can't do written transcripts. That's what I'm trying to say. Even if it's for your own personal use. Plus, that copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our parents' corporations page, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Boy, Wes, I hope that this evening improves, or I'm going to be one discombobulated host. Let me tell you.
Okay.
There's a menu up at the top, and we still have our store, and I'm putting out a plea for help. Cafe Press has gone on the blitz. You can't access our store. It's under the support menu. And if any of you know of or have experience with other online stores for logo wear, support wear, gadgets, things like that, you know, for websites or for companies, I would love to have your recommendations, because we can't get a straight answer from Cafe Press when they're going to fix their problem. Maybe they're going out of business. I have no idea. Seems to me they'd want to fix their website so they could make revenues, right? Well, maybe not. This is a new America. Who knows? But anyway, if you have any suggestions for another quality online store for logo wear and different items, you can put the Space Show logo on it, and things that you may be interested in, please send them to me by email. I would really appreciate it. We are looking for a replacement, and your help is certainly going to be important to us. And then there's other links up in that menu up at the top, so do check it out. You can do searches on our website now. If you're searching for a guest, search for the guest last name. If you have any questions about anything, do let us know. We are still fixing things from our website, and we're going to have a massive repair in a couple of weeks once Spencer is back from Asia. And we're going to finally fix the browser timing sequence for older shows older than October 2015. Yay, that'll finally get done. We do have sponsors for our new website and for the Space Show, and I do urge you from time to time to read those sponsor banner messages that go across the top, and we appreciate your doing that. And the Space Show is brought to you by two sponsors for the first half of our program. Integrated Space Analytics has the Integrated Space Plan. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. You can get into discussions, updates, participate in their exclusive interactive features. You can even buy a copy of the plan in one or two sizes as a poster. And it's a useful and inspiring tool. Hang it on your wall. And the website, again, thespaceplan.com. We thank them as a sponsor. Orbital ATK is a global leader of aerospace and defense technology. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And it's great to have Orbital ATK as a Space Show sponsor. So let me tell you about our guest tonight, and I am very happy to bring to the show for the first time Wes Ferris. Wes was referred to me several years ago by my good friend, who unfortunately has passed away and is no longer with us and is sorely missed, Declan O'Donnell. And for those of you that are frequent Space Show listeners, you know that Declan was a guest on the Space Show many, many times since I started the program back in 2001. What you may not know is that Declan, just out of the blue, I called him one day while I was writing my doctoral dissertation, and I said, you know, I'm not understanding these UN space treaties and some of the international space law items, and I see you're a noted Denver area tax lawyer, and you've got some chapters written in some books, including textbooks on space law. Can you help me? And boy, Declan just opened his heart and he opened his hands and we became good friends almost instantly. And I really miss Declan O'Donnell. He had United Societies in Space, USIS. He was a grand visionary, a dreamer. I think he was a really outstanding lawyer, but I never had to use his legal services. He was a tax lawyer for the most part. But anyway, he told me first about Wes, and Wes contacted me a couple of weeks ago. Wes made his first entry into the archives around space, claiming property in outer space during his college years in 2003, when he recorded a four-page affidavit claiming ownership to three stars in the Orion's belt. And he graduated in 2006 with a BS in communications. That might have been appropriate for claiming the Orion stars. We'll find out about that. He made the decision to use this project as a tool to obtain an answer from official sources on the legality of off-planet property claims under the Outer Space Treaty, sort of once and for all. He started a formal letter campaign and pinpointed the competent authority for these matters in the State Department and the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs. He made the decision to take up the issue of formal confirmation with the UN committee, and he did that. And while at the proceedings, and he actually went to the committee one year for the proceedings as a private citizen. While there, he approached competent U.S. authority, asking whether the claim in and of itself executed by a natural person stood in violation of the Outer Space Treaty. In the view of this competent authority, we'll ask him about that. On behalf of the United States, there wasn't a violation. And then this then paved the way for him to seek some kind of formal confirmation. And that is what you can see on the website that I have in the comments, that nothing in the underlying documents is prohibited by domestic or treaty law, clearing it for international use. And he says he has Secretary of State Rice's signature upon a claim of ownership for the three stars of Orion's belt, executed after contact with the competent authority for space treaty affairs. This was November 2008, was the first formal confirmation on behalf of the state, of a state, about private property rights, which were not unlawful under the Outer Space Treaty. I know this is pretty complicated, but he will break it down for us. He has also obtained multiple reaffirmations upon various such claims under the past three Secretaries of State and is now looking to gain similar confirmation outside the United States. So we're going to be talking about space property rights this evening, among a couple of other topics. Wes, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Hi, thank you for having me, David.
All right, correct all my glaring, confusing errors, and what's this all about?
Well, that was pretty much a good overview. For the past 10 years, I've been pretty serious into taking boots-on-the-ground action to confirm straight from the horse's mouth that claims to property rights are not patently unlawful under the Outer Space Treaty. In order to get some kind of positive affirmation in the field of property rights beyond national borders, period. I guess I'll start with, in 2003, of course, I after seeing Dennis Hope on a Conan O'Brien episode talking about his claim of ownership of the moon and the lunar embassy, I was inspired back in college, mostly as a joke or a party trick, to see if I could do the same thing with Orion's belt. And I registered, very politely asked them if there was any, at the county recorder's office in Knox County, if there was any way that they could get this onto the record, even though it didn't fit any of the classifications. They did, and I got on the news for that. I got the attention that I wanted, and then when the novelty of that wore off after college, I started to get serious about who has the actual answer on this. I hadn't seen any evidence to affirm or disconfirm anything from an official source. You had the climate of space claims back in 2006 was that you would have some people registering claims and saying, okay, that's it. The Outer Space Treaty doesn't have any language to deny this, and therefore I own this. Then the IISL, on the other hand, the International Institute of Space Lawyers, were putting out briefs doing backflips trying to disconfirm the legality of claims by switching around some of the language of the Outer Space Treaty. And I wanted to get the answer from an official source, one way or another. I was on the side of property rights. I was pulling for it. But at the end of the day, I didn't know if it was going to be confirmed legal or not once we reached the official source. So what is the official source? That was pretty complicated. There is no Office of Space Claims anywhere in the United States or the United Nations. So the letter writing campaign I started reached to the Attorney General of NASA, and he's the one that informed me that the competent authority within the U.S. is the Department of State, Bureau of Oceans and International Economic and Environmental Affairs, Space and Advanced Technology Division. I know that's a mouthful. Their acronym is OES/SAT. And then over at the UN, the Office of Outer Space Affairs. So I sent letters to both, not asking for confirmation or disconfirmation, just basically telling them to hold on to this in case something comes around and confirm that they had seen it or not. And at that point, I realized that if anything's going to be done, it's going to have to be done at the United Nations. I wasn't sure if there was any supranational entity within the UN that could, with the authority, to say yay or nay, this is legal under the Outer Space Treaty or not, but I wanted to put the Outer Space Treaty directly to a test. And without any litigation whatsoever. As a staple to this, I was accepted into the University of Aberdeen for studies in international law, and that put me over in Europe, pretty close to where the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space takes place in Vienna, which is where space law is hammered out. I was trying to gain entry as a private citizen, which is pretty hard to do. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but eventually, after a bunch of calls and letters, they finally let me in. It's turned out that year the Moon Treaty, which attempts to block private property rights for natural persons, was coming back up after 25 years in the committee, and that's where I took a stand on behalf of all natural persons. Article 11 of the Moon Treaty attempts to block property rights for natural persons, and my stance was these natural persons should at least be represented. And that's when they let me into the UN meeting, and I kind of put my Orion's Belt project aside for that meeting in order to focus on the Moon Treaty. And I put out a leaflet to the seven countries that were attempting to bring it in, basically on behalf of mankind, stating my grievances with the fact that it denies private property rights, and making the connection to the Law of the Sea, which does the same thing. But it was at that meeting that there's two things going on with the Orion's Belt Project at this point. Certification-wise, back in the U.S., there's a process called authentication for legal use abroad of legal documents, whereby any kind of legal document that's going overseas, especially to another government entity, has to go through this chain of certification that ends with the State Department confirming that the document can be used internationally. I didn't know if they took a look at the underlying document or not when I sent it to them at first, but this is going on at the same time I'm at the UN meeting. I got a letter back saying that it might be they're not going to certify this because it might be unlawful and against the public policy of the United States. And so this was a good point. This was finally a good point to test it. I knew that I was going to have to come back at this and get more details as to why. So this was the point where I figured I would get either an answer on this is unlawful because private property rights were never intended, were always intended to be excluded under the Outer Space Treaty. But the entity in which I would take this up with happened to be at the UN Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, representing the U.S. With the competent authorities from the Bureau of Oceans, and I had a sit down with them and told them all about my project, and the climate for private property rights and international treaties was very dim. You had the Antarctic Treaty, which prohibited any claims or assertion of claims, period, by any entity. You had the Outer Space Treaty, 1967, which was ambiguous. You had the Moon Treaty, which attempted to ban property rights. And you had the Law of the Sea, which, under Article 136 or 137, establishes the deep seabed as a place that is prohibited from claims by natural persons or appropriation by natural persons, and goes the full length on blocking private property rights out there. So this was language about natural persons and language about private property were not included in the Outer Space Treaty. It wasn't just that there was neutral language. I saw that there was language that could have been included that wasn't. And based on that, I asked them if they saw this claim, just the claim in and of itself, by a private person to the right to property under the Outer Space Treaty constituted a violation of the Outer Space Treaty. I didn't ask for confirmation of ownership or anything deeper than just the claim in and of itself. And they seemed to indicate that it was not a violation. And so to my return to D.C. to attempt again to get Secretary of State confirmation by authentication that this document can be used abroad and is not in violation of any U.S. treaty law. For that, I got the two authorities in touch with each other. I got the Bureau of Oceans in touch with Authentications and Authentications in touch with the Bureau of Oceans. Because that's the way the Office of Authentication works. If there's any kind of question, they refer the matter to the competent authority. Once I had them do that, in November of 2008, document unchanged, my claim of ownership for the Three Stars of Orion's Belt was authenticated by the U.S. Secretary of State under the Great Seal of the United States. And I believe that this served as my first confirmation, the second one, actually, the first being confirmation at the United Nations meeting that I wasn't in violation. But this put it to an official administrative action. This is executed on behalf of the United States. I had got the two competent authorities in touch with each other, and I believe that this was the first confirmation, positive confirmation, that property rights were not in violation of the United Nations Outer Space Treaty. And that's where I ended off with the Orion's Belt claim.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
There was a lawsuit with Nimitz about a parking on an asteroid. That got dismissed out of court and it didn't go anywhere. So didn't that set the precedent for
I'm glad
properties?
You asked that. So what they it did get thrown out in the official State Department administrative opinion, I'm going to say, was that the wording is very carefully placed here, that private ownership of an asteroid was precluded by Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. It did not say that it was outright denied. It said precluded. So that's why I chose my words carefully in asking if the claim in and of itself was in violation. If it was in violation, I think I would have been outright told this, and I don't think the State Department would have certified my documents for international use. And it just depended on the way that you phrased the question. See, Greg Nimitz is trying to get confirmation of ownership, and no court right now has the authority to bang a gavel and grant that. So, knowing that, I took the administrative route, and just phrase my question with the least common denominator of whether or not the claim in and of itself represented a violation. And if claims to property rights don't represent a violation, then I guess property rights themselves don't represent a violation, and therefore I don't believe that property rights were ever intended to be blocked by the Outer Space Treaty of 1967.
So I have gotten, since I put the comment on the show on Sunday, I've gotten about three attorney letters.
Okay.
And they're all saying the same thing. They say, we think that your guest is misunderstanding something. The certification is that the documents were notarized in the District of Columbia, and the notarization is legal, and since the District of Columbia is not a state, and you can't get them notarized in Texas or Oklahoma or California or Boston or Massachusetts or wherever, that they have to certify because the District of Columbia is a federal property, a federal district.
Oh, that's not the only.
Well, wait a minute.
Okay.
And they said that what they're saying is that these are properly notarized papers. They're not saying anything about the validity of your claims or what you want to claim. They're just saying, yeah, these are legitimately legally notarized papers.
And that's true. That's true. Most people don't think they look at the underlying content, but then again, most people haven't had a letter back from the chief authentications officer saying that, yes, we do look at the underlying content, and yes, we do analyze it against international treaty law, and we don't think that these documents are, we think that you're going to use these for patently unlawful purposes. I could read the letter that I got back, but it's a little lengthy, but the confirmation that I got was, I thought it was this kind of, I thought the process at first, too, was just a notary seal upon a notary seal. But when I got the letter back in 2006, it said that they do look at the underlying content, refer me to some code, 22 CFR 131.1 and 22 CFR 131.2 are the two codes that specify that the authentications officer can, it's at their discretion, whether to deny a document because they think that it's patently unlawful. So they look a little bit deeper into that. And
so do you think you have property rights now in space?
I think what I've confirmed is that property rights are not in violation of the Outer Space Treaty.
So this says nothing about you having a property right to any celestial body.
Well, it says that I have claimed ownership of the three stars of Orion's Belt. And if they're looking at the asteroid claim, it says that I've claimed ownership of asteroid number 160346. Apparently, that's what they were looking at. I'm not sure which document they were looking at, but
so do you think you own those items now?
Well, Glenn Reynolds once said in the interview in 2003, in my news interview, he came out against me saying that the county recorder cannot, properly give authority to STARS, which is true. And he said you'd have to either build a robot or just initiate something other than the fact that you had enough chutzpah to try. If you ask me, at this point, the work I've put in, me personally, I would say I've justified my ownership, but
you don't have any standing in court for that.
No, the goal is to avoid litigation unless it's absolutely necessary, and this was basically for.
Are you there?
Property.
I lost you for a minute. Are you there?
Are you there?
Yeah, now I'm here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is just a claim. If people are looking for the what entity I think says that I own it, nothing is confirmed. Nothing. No authority can grant ownership. But can private property rights be possible? Yes. But the document, as it stands now, is just a claim, and that's how I present it to. The competent authorities.
Jack in Tucson sent in an email and said, can you describe or define what you mean by property?
By property?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He wants a property definition from you.
The definition of property?
From you.
Okay.
What do you mean when you say the word property? What do you mean?
Property ownership. That's a good question.
I guess so. He asked it.
the right to exercise individual rights of any form over a plot of physical space. So the independent right to exercise control over any piece of physical territory. Would be my definition of property in this case.
Okay, so if it's a celestial body, which is forbidden in the treaties, then how do you?
Well, it's not forbidden in the Outer Space Treaty.
Well, it says you can't own pieces of celestial bodies.
Nothing in the Outer Space Treaty says that. And what I've done here is to in order to confirm. That it's the Moon Treaty attempts to block property rights, and it says even in the 13 countries have signed it only. That's where the attempt to block property rights is. But the Outer Space Treaty merely forbids national appropriation of any celestial body.
Right.
And so the question I was trying to drill down to that I think I have is whether national appropriation covers natural persons. And the answer that I got was that it does not. So under the Outer Space Treaty, we've got room to move forward. Under the Moon Treaty, is where the actual denying of the property rights takes place, and so that needs to be blocked. But no spacefaring country has signed the Moon Treaty, and over 100 countries have signed the Outer Space Treaty. And again, there's just no language. There's the purpose of this all was to confirm that the language of the Outer Space Treaty does not prevent private property rights from moving forward. They could have if they had included natural persons, which they've done in other treaties, or the term for property rights, which they didn't. But there's no. I could say without a doubt now that the Outer Space Treaty doesn't outright render private property rights patently unlawful.
Did you ever look into the background papers that supported the creation of the Outer Space Treaty to see what the founders of the treaty had to say about property rights and natural people and states?
I have. It really resonates that they wanted to leave this just up to, they wanted to speak just to governments. They wanted to leave the issue of private property rights for future generations. You had the U.S. and Russia sitting at the table, two nuclear countries with opposite ideologies on property rights, and they weren't gonna throw that in to the Outer Space Treaty just yet. So the foundational documents do tell a story about wanting to leave the issue of private property for the future.
So back in 67, there really wasn't any concept of private parties going to space. Commercial space wasn't the same thing as we talk about today. I mean, we had commercial companies making the spacecraft and the rockets for NASA and for the military and the ICBMs because we don't have state-owned businesses in America. But we weren't envisioning developing and emerging and successful private enterprise where privates were going to go to the moon. Like just the other day, we see where the government's about to authorize a launch license for Moon Express to go land on the moon. And none of this was contemplated back in 67.
Of course not. It was all
government.
Yes.
67, government to government.
You didn't start getting into the term natural persons in these treaties for territory beyond national borders until the Law of the Sea and the Moon Treaty. That's when you first started to see that come in. So it's like the Moon Treaty was created in order to fill a hole that some people saw in order to deny property rights. But that in and of itself should be enough proof that the property rights weren't rendered patently unlawful under the Outer Space Treaty. But you know, good luck getting the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space to admit that. If we could just get an admission that private property rights were never even included in the Outer Space Treaty from an official source, without having to, if I could have just gotten this answer from directly from somebody directly from the UN or the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, then I wouldn't have had to go through all these processes in order to confirm that. So I'm basically just looking for an answer that should have already been confirmed, but I had to go through all these steps to get it.
Linda is in Albuquerque with an email, and boy, I hope some of you are going to use the telephones tonight. You're not at work. I don't understand why you don't want to pick up the phone and call instead of just always use email, listeners. But anyway, let me give out the number again in case you missed it. It's 1-866-687-7223. Linda is in Albuquerque, and she says, well, not specifically in the Outer Space Treaty, but certainly in other treaties, there is the concept that space and all of these areas like space and celestial bodies are global commons.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, a global common excludes anything that an individual person, a natural person, or anything would have, because everything then is for the collective good, sort of like the Borg. So how do you address the issue that space or your asteroid or anything is probably a global commons?
Well, by the fact that within the U.S., the U.S. hasn't ratified any treaty that confirms any anything about property rights outside of national borders being global commons. Now, within those treaties, and only 13 countries have ratified the Moon Treaty, so yeah, legally speaking, within those 13 countries, space is considered a global commons, but...
It is a legal UN treaty, you know.
It's a UN treaty in force with 13 nations on board, and the Outer Space Treaty, largely probably because of that reason, has not been signed by most of the world. The Moon Treaty was roundly rejected in the negotiations in 1982, and then it came back from the dead. It was abandoned during negotiations. And it entered into force by five countries. The rule for that treaty to be entered into force was that five nations needed to sign it. The rule, for example, that the Law of the Sea, for its entry into force, it had to have something like 66 countries. So five countries being able to enter this into UN annals as a treaty that was blessed by the United Nations does not really represent a dominant worldview. My issue with these global commons treaties is that every time the United Nations gets a hold of a territory outside national borders and attempts to register it as a global commons, it always comes with a supranational authority that is appointed for governance of these territories, and it always blocks private property rights for natural persons. Those are two key issues with global commons treaties that I disagree with. That's done under the Moon Treaty and the Law of the Sea. And so I think these treaties should be abandoned. Actually, that's what I put out in my brief to the seven UN countries that were pushing forth the Moon Treaty back at the United Nations meeting, is that this treaty should be not just stopped or... negotiations halted, but abandoned by all the countries that have signed it. Because I think it's a thorn in the side of space property rights. As long as there is a treaty that's out there that denies it, even though it's not the dominant worldview, it's still going to be a thorn in the side.
Well, keep in mind the countries that signed it and others don't want private property rights to exist. So they're not going to abandon it. I mean, they'd like everyone to join on board. I have a funny story. I've told it on the space show before, but you reminded me of it. I'll tell it again. There's so many new listeners. About 5 years ago, you know, everybody should know who's listening to this show that the San Francisco Bay Area is very, very liberal. And Berkeley, where the University of California is, extremely liberal. So this is among the most probably liberal places in the United States. So I got a call one afternoon from the host of a Bay Area FM radio station, and I don't remember the call letters, but it is a very far left radio station, and they're very popular in the Bay Area, and they wanted to interview me about developing commercial space development going on in space. Again, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, so it was just talking, and people were starting to get excited about it, and SpaceX was in the early stages of trying to develop something and all of this. And so he's doing a pre-interview with me on the phone to set up the interview for 2 days from then. And he said, by the way, what are your thoughts on the importance of keeping space as a global commons? So there's about a 15-second pause on my side, and I said, well, you're interviewing me about my expertise in commercial space and the fact that the space show supports commercial space. So what do you think my thoughts are on keeping space as a preserve for global commons? I don't support it at all. And if you give me the time on your show, I'll be happy to articulate for a couple of minutes why I don't support it. Mm-hmm. There was about a 10-second pause, and he said, we've got a breaking story coming in. Let me get right back to you after I deal with this story. And I said, fine, I'm here all afternoon. You have my number. And, of course, I never heard back from him, and I never got the invite to be on the show. And that's because I did not support their agenda for global commons in space and to keep all the greedy capitalists and property rights guys out of space. That's what they wanted me to talk about. But when they found out I was representing the other point of view, there was no need to have me as a guest on their show.
It's very unfortunate these global commons treaties include natural persons without consent from any natural person whatsoever. And the first thing they do with the rights of natural persons is to completely block property rights.
Well, that's because they know best. But anyway, I don't want to go down that road. What is the impact? I mean, you're talking about the Moon Treaty. Let's deal with the Laws of Sea Treaty later. What is the U.S. and Russia or the Soviet Union never signed this thing. There's only a couple of countries that have signed it, a few more that have ratified it but not signed it. So what is the... Why do we care about it? Is there any impact from it other than with a handful of nations that don't have a lot of space power to begin with?
I'm glad you asked that question. It is a thorn in the side here, and I'll tell you that people were very unhappy with my letter that I put out at the United Nations, to the point where the head of the particular working group called security up to the room because they weren't used to a private citizen being in there.
Now, who are people? You say people.
Namely the head of the working group for that particular conference. He was so offended, first off, that a private citizen was even in the room, and second off, probably didn't like the things within the letter. So he called security. Security confirmed it. They're like, this guy, just don't worry about him. Just take a walk for a little bit and come back into the meeting. And I'm getting back to your question. This guy, I'm not going to name his name. He passed away recently. Openly yelled at me as I approached him after the meeting for the fact that this is supposed to be an international intergovernmental meeting, and why am I even here as a private citizen and all that. But the purpose of the letter was to point out the fact that the bad precedent set by the Law of the Sea Treaty with the abandonment of property rights beyond national borders, and to say that we're going down the same path with the Moon Treaty was not a good thing. I was invited back to the next year's meeting and then disinvited. The invitations just sort of kind of went away. Come to find out that the next year, in that same meeting, was the 30th anniversary of the Moon Agreement. And so it was a big Moon Agreement party. And
What impact does the Moon Treaty have on
Here's what I'm getting to. The paper that was put out by the Vice President of the Law of the Sea, who co-authored the Moon Treaty at the time, said that the Moon Treaty was meant to be respected by all nations, even ones who didn't sign it, or valid for all states, even those that didn't sign it. And that's what got me about it. I've never heard of a treaty that is universally binding, regardless of the signature. So for the past 2 years, in order to clear that up, I was working on a claim to asteroid number 160346, because within the Moon Treaty, the governing scope is the solar system. Now, the three stars of Orion's Belt are way outside the solar system, so in order to see if the Moon Treaty did have any impact, I went through the same process with a piece of property within the solar system, which Article 1 of the Moon Treaty states is its governing jurisdiction, the solar system outside of Earth. So it wasn't about just asteroids in particular. It was mainly to confirm that the Moon Treaty doesn't have any direct or indirect jurisdiction on it. Couldn't get a clear answer on what was meant by it was supposed to be valid for all states from the International Institute of Space Law. So again, I put these documents through the authentication process and got confirmation over letters and emails from the Bureau of Oceans, which is in charge of implementing the space treaties in the U.S. I was like, I know this seems redundant, but I need to confirm that the Moon Treaty doesn't have any indirect effect on us. Of course, with authentications, They could have seen that any clearance of this document for use abroad would be in violation of the 13 countries that signed the Moon Treaty, or that ratified the Moon Treaty. But that was successfully authenticated, and I got confirmation directly from the Bureau of Oceans that no, the Moon Treaty has no effect on us. So just to confirm that it somehow didn't, file documentation over an asteroid claim just to make sure the Moon Treaty isn't in our way. It was said that it was supposed to be valid for all states, but maybe it looks like it is not.
You have an email, and we're getting ready to go on break. We're at the halfway point. But this is June, and June is in Portland, Oregon. And June says, I'm trying to put all of this together. It seems a little bit confusing and rambling to me. But can you summarize what it is you're trying to claim or establish or develop a precedent for? For example, we've got a Commercial Space Act that has some sort of quasi-property rights for deep space mining, though many people believe that that language and that bill that was passed in December of last year is in violation of the Outer Space Treaty. There's no consensus that it's even valid in terms of U.S. property rights for deep space mining. So what is it you're actually after? What are you trying to claim, or what are you trying to create?
That property claims in and of itself are not in violation. Keep in mind, I was working on this. I started work on this a long time before the new U.S. law came out.
Right.
And the U.S. law doesn't go into claims in and of themselves. So immediately after the U.S. law was implemented, that's when the international community fired back and said, "Well, this could be a violation of the Outer Space Treaty. We'll have to see what other countries think about that." And so my plan here is here and right now is to work with other countries through a similar process to gain confirmation without litigation that this claim is not in violation of the Outer Space Treaty. So it's time to move on to other countries now, and so this will be eventually accepted by the international community.
So are you looking for Wes Ferris to have a specific property right, say, to the three stars in Orion's belt or the asteroid, or are you just looking to validate legally that private property rights are permissible?
The latter, the private property rights are permissible, I think is step zero. I think we're just now getting back to where we should have been had there not been any confusion to begin with. And so step zero is a validation that it's not unlawful under the Outer Space Treaty. And that's what I think that I have with the sum total of my documentation, and that's what I'd like to take forth to other countries.
Okay, so you're not saying, hey, everybody, I own these three stars, I own this asteroid. That's not what you're saying.
No, I don't even know if the term ownership will survive into the future. But, you know, in the future, when governments are a thing of the past, I'd like to have this confirmation as a stepping stone that what we're trying to do here was never in violation, just the bare minimum of what I can get. Not asking for confirmation of ownership or even a new term to describe ownership, but that the concept of property rights is not in violation.
Do you think, real quick before we go to break, that what the U.S. may do with these authentication organizations that you've been talking about, are they politically motivated, like would another president in 2017 with a new Secretary of State cause a different outcome? Or
doesn't seem to be the same way. It doesn't seem to be that way because I've filed these types of documents under the past three Secretaries of State and the past two presidents. So
it's not partisan.
No, I don't believe it's partisan. I think it's strictly based on treaty law.
Okay. Listeners, that's it. We're at the halfway point. We'll be back in about 3 minutes with Wes, and we would really like your phone calls. And again, 1-866-687-7223, and your emails can continue to come in, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do answer the phone during the break, so give us a call, and again, back in 3 minutes with our guest, Wes Ferris.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday Space Show program. We have two sponsors bringing you part two. So one of them is AIAA, and that is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. This is the world's largest aerospace professional society with 30,000 individual members from 88 countries. And they have about 95 corporate members. They are always busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and bringing the world closer together. And Celestis is the premier memorial spaceflight service in the world, and they are also a sponsor. Their message for tonight, preparing the next Earth orbiting memorial spaceflight. Celestis has achieved a major milestone toward the launch of the next memorial spaceflight from the Cape. Just last month, the first set of ashes was integrated into the orbital test bed satellite, now undergoing final construction and testing at the Surrey Satellite U.S. facility in Colorado. The satellite will orbit the Earth for at least 5 years and may be tracked on the Celestis website, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting the planet. The second set of ashes will be integrated into the satellite later this year, so there is still time to make a reservation for the mission. Attending a Celestis Earth orbit launch at the Cape is an exciting experience. Families meet others with loved ones on board the flight, talk with astronauts and mission representatives about the mission, tour the Kennedy Space Center, and they participate in a Celestis memorial service as well as viewing the launch. So it's celestis.org. And great company. And our guest tonight is Wes Ferris. We're talking about space property rights. We've been talking about the Outer Space Treaty, the United Nations, the Department of State, and also the Moon Treaty. And Wes, you have mentioned, but you haven't really discussed the Law of the Sea Treaty, which is another UN treaty, but the U.S. is not a signatory to that either.
No, they're not, but it's actually in technically in Congress right now.
Whoa. What do you mean technically in Congress?
Well, the Senate is the one that is the branch that ratifies treaties.
Right.
The House of Representatives has recently put out an official request for the Senate to take up that treaty.
Why?
Their justification of it is military action in the South China Sea, because there's parts of the Law of the Sea that cover that. I believe it goes into Russia's claim over the North Pole, which part of the Law of the Sea Treaty is the borders of international waters and where nations can stop their exclusive economic zone claims. Any excuse is enough but to avoid the part of the treaty which discusses the ocean floor under international waters, which is the deep seabed.
So they're concerned about China and the islands in the South China Sea and what Russia is doing, and they probably don't give a hoot about property rights on the floor.
Well, that's actually kind of the deep, dark secret. That's actually, in the 80s, President Reagan agreed to all other parts of the Law of the Sea and to implement U.S. actions accordingly, except for that one part. I believe that the thing holding it back is and always has been the deep seabed provisions, which puts an international authority called the International Seabed Authority, composed of appointed representatives, in charge of 70% of the Earth, which is the ocean floor under international waters. And again, within the provisions for that, excludes natural persons from exercising any kind of right. So it's the first treaty that I know of that can directly dictate the actions of natural persons. And what it dictates is that we can't have property rights, literally says that an authority is comprised to reflect the actions of mankind. And what the authority does is charge exorbitant fees for claim applications by private companies. And so pretty much killed the mining industry at the time. And like I said, the U.S. has come on board with every other part of the treaty except for that. So any excuse is enough to bury the lead on that, I believe, and put out fear about China and Russia. When the real issue is the supranational authority over the deep seabed.
So you're saying the concern over Russia and China is not warranted, but the real concern is they want to control the seabed?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's why there's very little mention of that. It's a huge part of the treaty.
So why do you think the concern over China and the South China Sea and Russia is not warranted?
There's concern over that, but it's there could be bilateral negotiations and talks between countries to cover that. We've come on board with it, every other provision of the law of the sea that has to do with that. So I'm not saying that it's not a concern, but I'm just saying that the only difference in U.S. law that will come about if this treaty is signed is the deep seabed provisions. Because we've aligned it with every other aspect of the treaty.
Have Russia or China signed this treaty?
Yes. Actually, about 150-plus nations have, which is kind of scary.
Well, wait. If they've signed it, then are you telling us that they're violating the treaty because of their actions in the South China Sea and around the North Pole?
I don't know about that within the law of the sea. I'm not here to comment on those parts of it. What I'm saying is that those parts of it would be used to seduce us into signing the treaty, and once we do, here comes the International Seabed Authority with control over 70% of the ocean floor. And I just think a healthy debate needs to be made in Congress if they are going to put this through. About the deep seabed provisions, is every time this treaty comes up, it just seems like any excuse is enough not to talk about that. And
is it coming up before the Senate, or is it just a chance that it may come
it's,
up?
The House of Representatives has officially asked the Senate to take up treaty ratification processes. And in the news the other day, there was something about President Obama demanding that the Senate ratify the law of the sea treaty. So it looks like a lot of pressure has been put up on them and on the Senate to take this up again. And from what I know from my D.C. contacts, usually when that kind of pressure is put on the Senate is when the time when the Senate officially takes it up. Last time this happened was around 2012 or 2011, I believe, and then before that, 2007. So we're right in the pocket for the treaty
It would pass if it comes up again?
Here's the thing: it's a very nonpartisan issue when it comes to that. You'll be surprised that most Democrats and most Republicans are on board with the treaty. There's very few that oppose it. And last time it came up, I believe it very well likely would have passed if it had gotten out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. With the analysis on senators that were in support of it, it was close. It was pretty close. So it would start out at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and then make its way to the full floor. And I'm not sure if it would. I don't believe it'll pass if the right arguments are made against it. If the deep seabed provisions come up. Then I don't think it'll pass. But somebody has to make sure that those arguments are put into place, because it sets a very bad precedent for property outside national borders.
So here's another email question for you, and this is from Dirk, D-I-R-K, in Helena, Montana. And he said the U.S. has never signed this treaty, yet there is no commercial activity going on, as far as I know of, to exploit the deep seabed. So is this even relevant? Do we even care?
Yes, they have signed it. We've signed it but not ratified it. President Clinton signed it in 1994. And here's the scary part about the whole thing as it connects to outer space. So back in the 70s and 80s, there was growing investments as far as deep seabed mining. I think even Howard Hughes was into it to some degree. And a U.S. law passed that was called the Deep Seabed Hard Minerals Act that would allow commercial exploitation, very much like the Space Act that was passed by Congress. So we're in the same kind of position here as we were back then, with investors on the side and a law with our protection. But in 1994, as soon as we signed the Law of the Sea, that seemed to crush the entire industry. So we're in a position here similar to where the Law of the Sea could be entering into the Senate again. And we got to be very careful, because last time it came in and the situation was similar with deep seabed mining, it ended up being crushed. But yeah, we have signed it but not ratified it.
So the fact that we've signed it means we're really honoring it, and there is no commercial exploitation of the seabed.
Well, we're not honoring it, but there are two companies active. I believe two U.S. companies are active in deep seabed mining. I forgot my list of the two companies that were active in it. There's very little activity that compared to what could have been. So it's not a moratorium. It's not completely crushed. But as soon as we signed it in 1994, the interest seemed to fade away.
Do you think it might become a presidential debate issue in the coming debates between Trump and Clinton?
No, I think that any action on this would take its course before that. This has been planned for a very long time, and I think that the process would get started, and the goal would be to finish it before the election cycle.
Have you seen any comments made on McConnell's willingness to bring it into the Senate?
Mitch McConnell, I haven't seen any comments on him, on his specific opinion on it. I've been looking for comments on bringing it into the Senate, but I haven't been able to find any of them yet. My hope is that it won't, but there's a lot of evidence that leads me to believe that it will.
Have you ever gone up there and testified before Congress on any of this?
No, but I've got an in with my senator from my home state of Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, is one of the people, luckily for me, on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that has been opposed to this treaty for years, and so I've met with his legal advisor up in D.C. And he ended up hand delivering a letter to John Kerry a few years back. With all of its grievances against the Law of the Sea, and he's determined not to let it pass. So I've got a lucky in with my home senator. I've requested from them that if it does come up, I would like to be somebody that is allowed to speak against it, because I just don't trust that anybody's going to bring up the deep seabed issue. Based on what I've seen before in the testifications.
Here's another question from you. Randy is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, can you quickly, rather than a long, lengthy, winding answer, summarize arguments as to why people or nations want to control the deep seabed and to deny any commercial operations or property rights? What is their rationale for this?
Well, because a supranational organization called the International Seabed Authority reaps all the profits from the charges that they exploit for mining operations.
But who's going to mine it? if they don't, if somebody else is exploiting the profit?
Companies that are approved by this organization, and so they are the ones that will give permission, and I guess that's the closest that you would get to title, is permission by the International Seabed Authority to A, explore, or B, mine. But exorbitant prices are charged for both of these operations.
Well, then how would they make any money? Why would they bother to do it?
Oh, how would the International Seabed Authority make money?
No, or how would the mining company make any money if they have to pay tribute to the Seabed Authority?
Because apparently the minerals that they're trying to mine are worth a lot more. These are polymetallic potato-sized nodules called manganese nodules.
Right, I know.
And there's a lot of worth to them. And so if you were to do that, commence operations, and I guess those would be. I guess there would be a value to that that's higher than the fees charged.
So this Seabed Authority could actually contract for ABC Mining Company to go down and mine these, and they pay them a contracted fee plus a percentage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the contracted company makes money, and the Seabed Authority gets to control and run it like the De Beers Diamond Cartel.
Exactly.
And they're supposedly going to distribute the profits, I guess, to the nations of that signed the treaty, or to the UN, or to something like that.
To some degree, yes. I'm not sure exactly where they get distributed, but I believe you're right on this.
You know, listeners, if there's anyone out there who really knows the law of the sea treaty, any attorneys listening,
please.
We'd really like to have you call in and comment on some of this stuff, because you said you went to the University of Aberdeen. Did you get a law degree, or did you?
In the middle of all this is when I went to the UN meeting, and long story short, I still owe them a dissertation, but I've recently been in contact with them, and they've welcomed me back to do it. So, getting into the UN as a private citizen was my prime directive, and when I had to hit go on that, I kind of. My studies, but
so you do not yet have a law degree.
Not yet, but
Have you completed all the coursework and you need a thesis? Is that
I just
what
need? I need a dissertation.
You don't pass a bar exam from that school, I guess, do you?
No. I would consider it possibly just to, after that, in case of a question on credibility. But pretty much just been the boots on the ground person trying to attain an honest answer in all this.
When you talk to people, and I know you've gotten a lot of media and press over the years, and you've done interviews, are you hated? Are you supported? Are you seen as a Don Quixote chasing windmills? How are you viewed by people?
Well, in the past, I would have been. I really haven't. This is the second interview I've ever really done. I mean, outside of the. In 2003, I did a news interview in Knoxville, and then that was pretty much it until about last year when I had two podcasts with the guys from Surfing the Divide, who are my good friends, and this is pretty much the third one. So,
so you haven't had that much press coverage?
I have not. I've been kind of working in silence, and this is me. Coming out with it, but I've had other contacts over the years that I've had a lot of support from people I've met. It usually seems to be pretty positive, but every once in a while, of course, you'll get somebody that just thinks the whole concept of space property rights is not worth taking the time to worry about, and that's pretty much the opposition that I get these days.
Carla is in Oceanside, California, okay? And she said, I'm wondering if you have allied with or been in touch with any space advocate organizations that support property rights, like the Space Frontier Foundation and probably a lot of others. Also, have you made any effort to reach out to any of the deep space mining companies? There are two of them in the United States.
And so I've done two speeches, which actually I should include. I wouldn't include that in media. And one at the University of at Montana State University Northern in Havre, Montana, and a second one at the Colorado School of Mines. And that's where I've made pretty good contacts within those industries. I still hadn't done any work on the asteroid side of things. But from the Colorado School of Mines conference, I received an invitation to the Canadian Embassy to their 50th anniversary / space mining forum to a panel, and where I was in the audience. And basically what I did there is there was a I would classify this as a moon treaty supporter.
How could you be classified?
Okay, so let me back up because I know I talk a little fast. The panel was comprised of one person from the Department of State, one person from NASA, two people from the private space mining organizations, and one person that was in support of the Moon Treaty, I would say.
Okay.
And I just raised a question there, like a seven-part question, just ripping the Moon Treaty to shreds. And I wasn't yet ready to stand up and say, look, I've claimed ownership of an asteroid and confirmed that it doesn't violate any treaty law because I didn't have an asteroid claim in hand. But that's when I knew that I was going to have to take that route and to confirm that the Moon Treaty didn't have any jurisdiction before I could do any of that. So haven't really reached out to many people yet, but there's some initial contacts made.
Did you ridiculed or disciplined when you attempted to rip the Moon Treaty to shreds at that Canadian event?
Not really. Somebody else had to answer the question. And my question was why is this treaty still being sought after? There had been three signatories in the past few years. Why is this? And basically the answer was, we really don't. It's really not that much of a threat to go after and try to put a stop to for real. And I said that we should really stop the Moon Treaty because it's not dead. And it is slowly avalanching. But no, not really. It really wasn't ridiculed for that.
Bob in Boston sent in an email, and he says several years ago there was talk that two signatories to the Moon Treaty were considering withdrawing and pulling out of it. One was Holland, and I believe the other was Australia. Is there been any follow-up to that?
I know that they're still on board as a ratifying country. I'm glad to hear that news because I had never heard that before. I'd never heard that there was talks of them bowing out. I know in the past 3 years there have been three new ratifying nations, but I would hope that if two countries bow out of the Moon Treaty, then what we might see is an avalanche of other countries until such time as it is no longer a treaty in force.
Who are the three that joined it?
So since 2008. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Kuwait have ratified or acceded to the Moon Treaty.
Why the hell would they?
I don't know. You never really, get any news on
the why
treaty proceedings. I was just checking out the list of ratifying countries and could find no news articles on it, but found out that Kuwait most recently ratified it. There's something that I skipped over on the Moon Treaty that I'd like to tell you about real quick, which is that the International Institute of Space Law, last year, December 20th, after this, in response to the U.S. mining law, I'm going to say, because I can't place the entire
uh-huh.
title of the law, they responded to it basically saying that, yeah, we need more countries on board with this, and we're not sure that this though it's a good first step that it'll be internationally accepted. But within that, there's a paragraph stating, and I've been putting pressure on them for about 10 years to comment on this, stating that, yes, the Moon Treaty is still active. Yes, there's been X amount of nations that have ratified it. But to clarify, the United States has not ratified the Moon Treaty, and so it is not binding. And that's the International Institute of Space Law reaffirming that the Moon Treaty is not binding on the United States, at least.
So then it wouldn't be binding on Russia either, I take it.
I'm guessing not. They said just the United States, but I wish they had said all countries that have not signed or ratified it, but the confirmation that I was seeking was just the United States.
Has there been any discussion or effort that you're aware of within the United States to actually sign and ratify the Moon Treaty?
Not in quite some time. When it comes up in the UN Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, the U.S. usually stays out of commenting on it, or if they do comment on it, it's kind of like, well, we're pretty good where we're at right now. We think that the current treaty landscape is acceptable. So there's been no comment from the U.S. on or doing anything close to signing or ratifying the Moon Treaty. I'll just stop there.
Okay, so you've got Penny is in Denver, Colorado, and she says, I listen to a lot of space show programs, and David has had several space lawyers on, and they claim that treaties are, in a sense, falling out of order in the international and national community, being replaced by trust agreements between countries, as they are easier to get up and running and easier to enforce, and treaties have become almost impossible to ratify and sign. So do you know anything about that? Are there any space trust agreements that you're aware of that are being considered by the United States or other countries that might do the same thing as the Moon Treaty or the Law of the Sea Treaty, except instead of needing to be a treaty ratified by the Senate and all of that, it would just be a trust agreement between countries, not necessarily needing Senate approval?
I'm not familiar with any of that at this time. I'm focused entirely on the treaty law that's in existence. I hope that those future trust agreements, should they take place, would be favorable to space property rights. But as of now, I'm not familiar with any goings on relating to that.
I don't know if they've ever addressed any property rights. Again, there's a lot of attorneys that have been on the show and that listen to the show. I would hope some are listening, and maybe one of them will call us before the end of the program tonight. Mm-hmm. And again, I'll throw out that number. It's 1-866-687-7223. Do you have a recommendation for commercial space for the industry in general? Do you have something that you think advocate organizations ought to be advocating or lobbying for, or is this all just a one-man show?
Well, right now, at this point, I guess I would be the lobbying organization, and I would suggest that if anybody wants to join me in taking this issue up with other nations and getting confirmation that outer space property rights are not in violation of the Outer Space Treaty, then welcome.
Why is it so important that you ascertain that they're not in violation of the Outer Space Treaty? Nobody is yet in a position to go out and do any deep space mining or claim a celestial body or a celestial property right. Plus, the Outer Space Treaty allows for people to work a claim and profit from that. And as long as they continually work it, they're entitled to the benefits of that claim. They don't even have benefit sharing, even though that's another concept in the treaty, but more so in the Moon Treaty. And we haven't even talked about benefit sharing tonight. But so why is this a pressing issue? Is it really needed?
Absolutely, because it's been an ambiguous issue for the past 50 years, and I believe it's good to cut the red tape that may hold it down to Earth ahead of time. And B, with the Moon Treaty and the Law of the Sea, it's evident that there's been a movement to destroy it since 1979. So, yeah, I think those precedents are important to establish now so it doesn't hold us back.
But the effort to destroy property rights has not come from within the United States, has it?
No, absolutely not. It's come from it's come from the international community, I'm going to say, under these treaties. So, not within the United States. So that's why I would like to get the same kind of confirmation from other countries until it eventually breaks down the attitude that still seems to be coming from the international community that there might be a question. Even a question on the issue. And I think if enough countries are, if we can get proof from enough countries that we're not in violation, that and the attitude from the international community that the Outer Space Treaty may have prohibited that will slowly start to secede.
Fascinating. Charlie is in Chicago, and Charlie says, it would seem to me that the companies that want to commercialize space and do something with a celestial body would be at the forefront of trying to push for space property rights, but that's not the case, is it?
Well, these companies seem to be focused on technology, from what I gather, and that's their main focus right now. I believe it'd be advantageous to them, but from what I've heard, their focus is on technology. So, yes, I agree.
It's focusing on technology. Well, I guess they need the technology to go out there and make a claim or something to property rights, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're more concerned with the technological aspects of actually retrieving and landing than I believe that from what I've heard on the legal issues.
Many countries, Wes, do not have private property rights like the United States does. So, again, I can't say that we're an exception in the world, but we're one of the few where we can own private property, mortgage property, borrow against property, sell property, pretty much unfettered by the government, although, you know, we obviously have to be legal about it and get title and all of this. So are we looking for property rights to be like U.S. property rights in space? But what about all these countries that don't identify with what the United States does?
Well, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations states that no one shall ever be arbitrarily deprived of the right to property, and that everybody should have the right to property.
Does that include real property?
It just says property.
Okay.
And so this definition can be expanded, or it can how we execute it can change. And so whether it goes back to the nations, or whether it's a consortium of private citizens or private entities with industry standards, remains to be seen. The focus now is the fact that it's not denied in the infancy of space exploration.
And of course, we know how well the Declaration of Human Rights is honored by all the member countries of the UN, right?
Well, what I was stating was it's a
subject for another show.
Internet. There could possibly be an international recognized organization that actually supports the rights of private property that deals with these issues, but currently, what's taking place under the United Nations is looking like that if there was such an organization, it would be unfriendly. So whether that's administered by an international organization comprised of private entities in the future, like I hope it might be, remains yet to be seen.
Fascinating. Do you work on this every day, or how do you proceed?
Well, over the past 10 years, I've always had a couple of actionable items within this. I've had other jobs and whatnot, but this has pretty much been my life's work over the past 10 years. And so there's long-term goals and short-term goals that something gets done on it probably on a daily basis.
Do you have an actual day job, so to speak?
Yes. I have a web design and search engine optimization contracts for companies, and that's been my bread and butter.
So you're not trying to make a living on this?
Well, I have to have something to support this.
Okay. Well,
I've spent money on documentation that I've tried to file and trips to different places to get things done in this project. So
So what's next?
What's next is looking into other countries, looking into getting the same confirmation with other countries.
Well, have you prioritized the countries? Like, where do you go first?
I'm talking to a couple right now. I don't really want to name the countries right now. I think I would rather leave that for a future show when I do have some kind of action, because I'm afraid if I say it now, it won't happen. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, there might be some people who hear about it and then raise holy hell.
Mm-hmm. So I'd rather slide in under the radar with those countries, and hopefully it's looking pretty positive from what I'm seeing so far. But you know, that remains to be seen.
Do your friends think you're a whack job?
Yes and no.
Or family think you're crazy?
Yes and no. Everybody's kind of seen that just come together over the past 10 years, and from when I'm able to explain it to people, they could see the point. But if you just take a general look at it, you might think I'm out in the weeds somewhere. Anybody that really knows what it is I've been working on is pretty much in full support. My family's always been in support. Got some good friends listening right now that are letting me use this landline that are definitely in support. So,
yeah, if you were in Colorado or Washington State, they might think you're breathing too deeply out there. We're coming up on the end of the program. Any closing comments, pearls of wisdom, any takeaways you would like us to hold on to?
So we're closing up here. Just to summarize, I believe that precedent's been set that private property rights are not in violation of the Outer Space Treaty, and moving onward and upward, making sure these other treaties that are attempting to block us are not ratified, and it's pretty much what I have to say to close.
Okay, we thank you for coming on, and I trust you will, now that we've met, you'll keep me apprised of your efforts.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Thank you for having me on.
How did you meet Declan?
Oh, big shout out to Declan before I leave. That's what I need to do here. So he had a organization called United Societies in Space.
Right, you said.
And during these Colorado conferences that I would go to, I met some contacts that were in with him, and got invited to his kitchen cabinet meeting, and me and him just gelled pretty well.
I was always invited, but I never flew over there to go to it. But I talked to him on the phone a lot, and I loved him dearly. And it's too bad he's gone.
Yeah, it's too bad. He was really a force to be reckoned with.
I think so, especially when he was healthy and younger. So.
Mm-hmm.
Anything we forgot to talk about or that you wanted to talk about that we've omitted?
Looking at my list here, I think I've gone through all the points, actually to the point where I'm starting to go back to the beginning. So
so we've made the circle.
We've made the circle. You know, unfortunately, nobody actually called in, but I tend to do better on questions than speeches. So my last speech in Colorado, the question and answer session lasted twice as long. So I'm happy to field any questions. That really helps me organize how I try to bring this forward. And hopefully, thanks for having me on the show.
Okay.
And I can look at this and be able to present a clear picture going forward.
Okay. Well, I'll get this archived in the morning, and I'll email you the information. And pay attention to the Space Show blog, because if listeners have comments and questions for you, they'll post it on the blog for this show. So the link that I send you will take you to this location on the website once it's archived, and if you just scroll down, you'll get all the comments and the blog comments, and you can comment back to the listeners if you want.
Okay.
And so look for my note in the morning, and stay in touch. And thank you for sharing this information with us. It's been an interesting and an informative discussion. I appreciate your being here.
Okay, thanks for having me. Okay. I'll definitely keep you in the loop.
Okay, listeners, that's it. So Hotel Mars is talking about Comet 67P and the finding of organics on it. And then we have Friday and Sunday Space Show as planned. So keep listening. Everybody, keep looking up. Thank you for listening to The Space Show. Good night from Wes, David, and The Space Show.
Good night.